From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Russia is boosting security at its embassies around the world following yesterday's assassination of Russia's Turkish ambassador in Ankara. A spokesman for Russian President Vladimir Putin says the assassination, quote, benefits those who want to drive a wedge between Russia and Turkey and derail peace talks for Syria. The ambassador, Andrei Karlov, was giving a speech at an art gallery when he was shot dead by an off-duty Turkish police officer. Afshin Yurdakul is a Turkish journalist and anchor at Habertürk News Network. She joins us via Skype from Istanbul. And Afshin, tell us more about what we know about the gunman.
The gunman is identified as Mevlüt Mert Altıntaş. He's a 22-year-old member of Ankara's riot police squad. He was allowed to carry a weapon into the event because he was carrying his police ID card, and there wasn't anything suspicious when he entered the venue. What we know is that he is known to have shouted slogans in Turkish and in Arabic saying, don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria. And today, Turkish and Russian investigators have begun working together, and they are conducting a joint investigation of the assassination of the attack that took place in Ankara yesterday.
So, of course, this is all, as you said, still very new, and there's much we don't know. But do we have any indications yet that he may have ties or have had ties to extremist groups or even groups that oppose the Turkish government?
Look, the interesting thing there is the slogans he shouted, don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria, in Turkish and in Arabic. Like I said, we will know a lot more once Turkish and Russian investigators start working on this case. Keep in mind, there were protests outside Russian consulates in Ankara and in Istanbul about Aleppo and what was taking place in Aleppo. However, there's absolutely no evidence at the moment whether he acted alone and what the motives might be behind the attack, whether he is on his own, acting on his own, or was part of an organized terror attack. So we don't know. But so far, what he said before he shot the ambassador seems like an important hint, which the investigators will be focusing on.
Tell me, what has the reaction to yesterday's terrible events? What has the reaction been in Turkey? What are the Turkish people saying?
It's a big shock. It's a big shock, I have to say. And Turkey recently had a lot of terrible experiences with a string of attacks taking place in major cities, including the capital, including Istanbul, and most recently the central Anatolian town of Kayseri. So Turkey has been dealing with a string of terrorist attacks recently, and this comes after such a somber mood in the country. Obviously, ties with Russia, you know, Turkey had its ups and downs ever since the downing of the Russian jet late last year. However, things seem like it's back on track, and both Turkey and Russia are trying to fix the ties, and we see more cooperation in Syria. We see more cooperation regarding trade ties and energy ties and tourism, which are all important avenues of cooperation between the two countries. So it was absolutely a shock and was unexpected. Now, that's the public reaction. And from Turkish officials, too, from the government, we see the same thing of both the foreign minister and the president and the prime minister all framing this as an act of provocation to derail the peace process in Syria or joint Turkish and Russian efforts to bring peace to Syria and other areas of cooperation between the two countries as well. So that's how they're interpreting and framing last night's events. And obviously, once we know more about what may have motivated the gunman, we'll see how the government in Ankara will be reacting as well.
So let me ask you about that, because so much has happened both in Turkey and to Turkey in the past year, because there was that attempted coup as well over the summer. How might yesterday's assassination of the Russian ambassador, could it potentially have any impact on the presidency of President Erdogan?
I doubt that. I mean, so far, the reaction in Ankara is that it's a very careful and meticulous effort to manage the situation. And immediately, officials began investigating the case and cooperating and communicating with Russia, with the officials in Kremlin. And we see the same reaction from Russia as well. Russia also is portraying this as an act of provocation. And it seems like both Turkey and Russia are trying to align their narratives and approaches regarding what took place and what its impact might be.
Afshin Yurdakul is a Turkish journalist and anchor at Habertürk News Network, speaking to us today from Istanbul. Afshin, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Megan.
And now, what is going on in North Carolina? For the second time in 2 weeks, lawmakers have been called back to the Capitol for a special session. This time, sitting Republican Governor Pat McCrory is asking legislators to repeal the controversial House Bill 2 law, known as the Bathroom Bill, which requires transgender individuals to use restrooms in most public buildings based on the gender assigned at birth. The law cost the state millions of dollars after major sporting events, including the NCAA championships, pulled out of the state. It possibly also cost Governor McCrory a second term. And in the first special session last week, lawmakers actually stripped the Democratic incoming governor, Roy Cooper, of some of his authority. Jeff Tiberi is a political reporter for Here Now, contributor to WUNC. Jeff, start with the bathroom bill and the move to get lawmakers to repeal it tomorrow. This was part of a deal. On Monday, Charlotte City Council repealed their competing ordinance that actually protects transgender people from discrimination. So how did this all happen?
It's a good question, and I think we know some of the details, but certainly not all of them, or possibly some significant ones at this point. As listeners may remember, House Bill 2 came about in a hastily called special session back in March. It came after a city ordinance, as you mentioned, from Charlotte. And there have been rumors and innuendo that there was a deal. If locally they would rescind, then the state would repeal. And we've been hearing about this for months, but it really has never been firm. The leadership, the Republican leadership at the state level, has never come forward and said, we will repeal if they rescind. Now, they've said that in the last couple of days. They've said that within the last day, they've said this deal's been on the table for months. That's not entirely accurate. They haven't really touted this plan before. But to answer your question, the city council ordinance was rescinded yesterday, contingent upon lawmakers repealing House Bill 2 in full by December 31st. So what is today, the 20th? We have 11 days to see if that happens. But that is that's the deal that evidently is going to move forward tomorrow.
Well, the legislature is controlled by Republicans. Will there be enough votes, or is everybody looking at the state's bottom line?
It's a very key question right now. A leading House Republican told me this morning that they are not certain they have the votes in that chamber, in the North Carolina House. I'm told that in the North Carolina Senate, there will be enough votes for repeal, but they are working through the House, which is the bigger of the two chambers, a more diverse Republican caucus, to find out if they have these votes. Presumably, the Democrats would vote for repeal. But the issue right now, just a few days before Hanukkah and Christmas, is that there are a number of lawmakers who are traveling. There are some lawmakers, presumably, who might be facing re-election challenges as we head toward a special election in 2017 that don't want to weigh in on this one way or the other because it could hurt them from an electoral standpoint. So we don't know how many of the 120 House members are going to be there tomorrow. So the question right now is, are there enough votes in the House to repeal? They're working on that. And what I'm told is they'll have a better idea after a caucus meeting. That's a closed door meeting this evening.
Well, you have the incoming Governor-elect Roy Cooper, a Democrat. Does he have any kind of powers like the president does of any kind of executive decision on this?
The executive powers are certainly a top of mind here after last week when the lawmakers came in and stripped the would-be Democratic governor-elect Roy Cooper. We have a Republican going out. Yeah. We have a Democrat coming in, stripped him of some of those powers. He has the power of the bully pulpit. There's nothing functional that Cooper necessarily can do at this point. He now is taking credit in terms of helping to broker this deal, convincing more of the city council members in Charlotte to be on board with this. So he gets to come out of this potentially and say, you know, I helped orchestrate this deal. And if it moves forward, I would contend that this is potentially a good moment for Republicans as well, because it looks as, though in this instant they're willing to compromise. They're willing to work with the Democratic governor. And coming out of last week when there were a lot of, there was some not so great press for the Republicans, right? Well, as they took away authority, they might get some better headlines.
Well, to talk more about that session last week, the outgoing Republican Governor Pat McCrory said he signed the legislation that would strip his Democratic successor of the governing control that he, McCrory, enjoyed. How do you do that?
I would summarize it quickly as you were a Republican first and a governor second? And what you're talking specifically about, Robin, the current Republican governor has signed law that will significantly change the incoming Democratic governor's appointment powers, the size of the staff, the number of positions that he can have moving forward. It removes his authority over the state board of elections. So some pretty significant executive powers took place last week. And as you kind of note, there's certainly some irony in that.
Yeah. And some, as you say, it sounds like eyebrow raising. Well, a lot going on there in your state. Jeff Tiberi, political reporter for WNC. We will follow to see what happens tomorrow as legislators are asked to roll back that so-called bathroom bill there in North Carolina. Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure. Happy holidays.
You too.
Sarah Blakely was just 29 when she founded the shapewear company Spanx. Today, she remains sole owner of the company, and at 45, she's the youngest female billionaire in America. The Spanx story is now legendary. Blakely was a door-to-door fax machine saleswoman when she cut the feet out of a pair of control top pantyhose to create a product that she could wear under her slacks. Blakely didn't have much of the time, just $5,000 in savings, but she did have a tireless drive to succeed. Her first big break came in 2000 when she landed a meeting with retail giant Neiman Marcus. Now, I spoke with Sarah Blakely recently, and she clearly remembered how that first pitch meeting went. Things were not going well.
Halfway through my pitch, I could tell I was completely losing her. I mean, she was just not, I could tell she was losing interest. She was so perfectly dressed, like her pen matched her dress, that matched her shoes. And I had a Ziploc bag from my kitchen with my prototype of Spanx in it, Ziploc bag. I had my lucky red backpack with me, which was my presentation bag from college, which my friends begged me not to bring. They're like, you cannot go to the Neiman's headquarters
with the red backpack.
With the red backpack, but it was lucky, so I brought it anyway. And so I just said, you know what, excuse me, will you please come down the hall with me and come into the bathroom with me? And she just kind of shifted in her chair and went, okay. And I said, I'm just going to show you my product on me, like what it can do. And I went in the stall and I had them on under my cream pants and came out and showed her. And then I went back in the stall, took them off, came out in the cream pants without them. And she went, oh, wow, I get it. And this is brilliant.
And she decided to buy them right there, right?
She bought them right there. She said, Sarah, I'm going to try you in 7 doors and see how it goes. And I mean, I was out of my mind. It was the first place I'd cold called.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody there. You know, I lived in Atlanta. I started with the Neiman's buyer locally down the street. And that's when they laughed and said, you need to call our buying office in Dallas. I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know you had a buying office.
But then I love it because your drive, I mean, it wasn't just that one moment, right? There was like a series of things even after that happened. Like I read that you wanted Neiman to see that Spanx could sell, right?
Yes.
So you kind of created your own little market at the beginning.
You have to. As soon as I got into Neiman's, I jumped into action to absolutely ensure success. I mean, no matter what I needed to do. So I did 2 things. One is I called every friend in those 7 cities or friends of friends that literally I hadn't talked to in forever and said, will you please go into Neiman's and buy Spanx and I'll write you a check. And so I was paying all of my friends and friends of friends to do this. And at the same time, then I went into Neiman's and stood in the department store from 8:30 until 7 every day around the country in those 7 stores. My biggest challenge was going to be, I mean, it was amazing that I got into Neiman Marcus, but my product was put in the sleepiest corner of the store where it was in the hosiery department. And this product was for women that you may never go into the hosiery department. So I recognized that. So I would set up a display table and stand in the entrance of Neiman's or by the shoe department and literally show people my product on me all day.
Without telling anyone at Neiman's, you would just do this?
Well, yes, because then everyone thinks someone else approved it. I mean, it's so important to just ask for forgiveness and not permission when you're starting out. You know, I just kept saying, I'm going to ask for forgiveness as long as I'm not harming anyone or breaking any serious laws. Like, I just need to do this because you always know the answer is going to be no.
I love every minute of this. I mean, I have to ask you, I'm talking to you now, years after your company is wildly successful, you're a billionaire. I think Forbes said that you're the youngest female billionaire in America. So obviously you're successful and confident. Did you feel this kind of the confidence that you're projecting now? Did you feel that when you were in the earliest days of Spanx, when you were doing all these things and hoping to have to ask for forgiveness later?
It's such a great question. I mean, I think courage is a muscle, and you have to keep pushing yourself and putting yourself out there in order for it to get stronger and stronger. But I'm scared and nervous all the time. But I just think we got one shot. It's not a dress rehearsal. Here we are. I don't want to hold myself back because I'm afraid someone might judge me, or someone might look at me funny, or I might embarrass myself.
This is so great to hear, because obviously every entrepreneur takes risks, right? I mean, just by virtue of being an entrepreneur, you're taking risks. But I feel like the risks are even greater for women, because oftentimes we've talked to a lot of them on our show where they say, you know, it's easy to hear that voice in your head saying no. It's easy to hear that voice in your head like anticipating the rejection. And that's why I love the foundation story of Spanx, because it seems like you did the opposite of that. Like, you might have heard that voice, but you just ignored it.
Well, that leads me to talk about two things. One is, when I first thought of the idea for Spanx, I didn't tell any friends or family for 1 year. So I kept it completely private to myself and worked on it at night and on the weekends, because I was still selling fax machines door to door when I thought of the idea. And I did that for one main reason, is because out of love and concern, people will bring up things you should worry about, right? You know, and they're coming from the best place ever. But by telling people your idea or what it is, your dream or what you're wanting to do, you're just for validation, you're opening yourself up. And I didn't want to invite ego into the process so early on. So instead of having to defend my idea and explain it to a bunch of well-meaning people, I just quietly spent the time pursuing it. And ideas are the most vulnerable in their infancy. The minute you have them, and it's human nature, in the minute we have them, to turn to our coworker, our friend, our husband, our wife, and tell them what the idea is. And when I finally did share the idea, I heard, well, honey, if it's such a good idea, how come no one else has done it?
Uh-huh.
And then I heard, you know, well, honey, even if it is a good idea, you're going to spend your $5,000 set aside in savings, and the big guys will just knock you off in 6 months and, you know, put you out of business. And I think if I had heard those things right when I cut the feet out of my pantyhose to wear my white pants to the party, I'd probably still be selling fax machines.
Oh, geez.
Or something else, because I don't even think fax machines exist anymore. But, you know, another thing is, I was cold calling selling fax machines door to door for 7 years. And I heard nothing but no all day, every day. So it was just laying the groundwork and giving me really good training. But I definitely had my days where I'd get in the car and cry. I'd just drive around the block, cry. I mean, people would escort me out of their building, and security guards would ask me to leave for soliciting. And I would get business cards ripped up in my face like once a week. But I found that cold calling, I have so much respect for anyone who's ever done that.
You are so successful, and have you always been so driven, right? Because I don't think that you would have gotten as far or as done as well as you did if you didn't have an internal drive from the start.
I feel like I have been driven for most of my life. And when I think about where that comes from, I think part of it is DNA, but I think part of it is, I can't explain it, but since I was little, I've had this gratitude for being a woman born in America at the right time and in the right place, and knowing that I had nothing to do with that, that that was just sort of luck, and wanting to do the most I could possibly do with this moment in time and this opportunity, and recognizing how many women came before me that didn't have the opportunity, and how many women still now around the world don't. That's been a big driving force for me.
Wow. I read, I think it was in The New Yorker, that when the Spanx website was first launched, that your mom had a luncheon party or something.
Yes.
And she accidentally, because of the name, directed people at the luncheon party to a completely different kind of website. Is that true?
Totally true. My poor sweet mom, she sent all of her friends at the luncheon to the wrong website, Spanx. So if you want to go to Spanx.com, I highly recommend you spell it with an X, or you're going to get a real treat. Like, my mom and all her sweet friends. She called me up. She's like, Sarah, all my friends are commenting about your new business. I'm like, Mom, how did you spell it?
It's the one with the X, everybody.
Yes.
Don't forget.
But you know what? I just joined social media. I have not been on any social media. I joined Instagram 6 weeks ago, Meghna. And listen, that was a fear of mine too, believe it or not.
So one thing which I always ask, can you tell me the story of a time where something didn't quite go right, an idea or a project failed, and you didn't anticipate that failure? And what was it, and how did you deal with it?
Well, the first thing comes up, and that was a little bit earlier in my journey, which was I'm a terrible test taker, and I wanted to be a lawyer, and I failed the LSAT.
I feel your pain.
Are you a bad test taker?
Well, I failed the LSAT.
I mean,
I didn't go on to found a billion-dollar company,
it's
though.
It's so hard, the LSAT. I don't know. I debated all through high school, all through college. Like, my major was legal communications. That was my path. And I took the LSAT and basically failed it, took the course, took it again, and failed it again, basically. I mean, my score was so low, I had to, like, it was barely on the page. And so that was really a disruptive moment for me and my path, but life had other plans for me. And I often like to talk about how if you think you're failing at something, it's usually life's way of nudging you and just letting you know you're a little off course. And when I was growing up, my dad used to encourage me to fail. And I would sit at the dinner table and he would ask my brother and me what we had failed at that week.
Huh.
And if we didn't have something to tell him, he would be disappointed. And I can remember coming home and saying, Dad, I tried out for this and I was horrible. And he'd go, way to go, and high-five me. And what he was doing was reframing my definition of failure. So failure for me and my brother now is simply not trying versus the outcome.
That's fantastic.
So that was a big gift my dad gave me growing up.
And boy, did it work. Sarah Blakely is founder and CEO of the shapewear company Spanx.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
And some people get their Christmas trees at the supermarket, some at a farm, others cut them down in the national forest, take them home and get out the ornaments. But as Sean Hurley from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio found out, not everyone does the bring the tree home part.
I was out walking last week on the Pine Flat Ski Trail in my hometown of Thornton. It's not flat. I've never seen a skier there. But there are pines. The trail runs alongside Smart's Brook. And as the trail rises, the brook falls away into a deep, moss-clad gorge. At the height of land, there's a pine forest. Green triangles everywhere, as my son Sam once said. And it was here, amongst these green triangles, about a half mile from the road, that I found a fully decorated Christmas tree. Next day, I took my wife and son to see it. We brought along an ornament to hang on the tree, to sort of add to it, to join up with whoever it was that decorated it in the first place. But halfway there, we came upon a group of 7 men decorating their own tree beside the path.
We did this a while ago, actually, in Peterborough on a hike. And I think we just thought about, oh, what a cool thing to do. And we went out on a hike and we decorated a tree. We brought presents with us and we exchanged presents at the same time.
And with a Christmas party planned for today at his house, Mike Bovaire thought it was time to do it again.
So we decided, why not go for a hike before we have the party and find a tree to decorate? I mean, I put out the idea. No one said, what a crazy idea, right? You guys were okay with it, right?
I think it's great. It's happiness. Brings a smile to your face. We all brought something.
Rob LeVerger holds up a red star and a silver bell as Rick McCurdy removes and hides his jingle bell hat and handful of ornaments as though the Christmas police might be nearby.
My feel like I'm going to get arrested. So whose idea was this? Who did the decorations? Just kidding.
And if the Christmas police ever did ask them these questions, John Norman has an answer.
We're going to come back in March and take everything down. So we are going to check on it every now and then. Maybe people will add to this one also.
Or maybe the tree next to it will start getting decorated and we'll have a little Christmas tree decorated
contest. Yeah, there'll be like 3 trees, 4 trees, 5 trees decorated in this area. Yeah. We'll start a new tradition out here.
After Rob LeVerger sets his red star on the top of their tree, the 7 continue their hike until they come upon the decorated tree I found the day before.
Yeah, they didn't bring it all the way to the top. There's no tree topper, so ours is much better.
Well, what's kind of nice about it is someone is doing on behalf of not really themselves, but for other people.
In the middle of nowhere. It's like, what were they thinking?
My wife and son find an empty space in the tree and hang our ornament as the 7 wild Christmas tree decorators head off. And as we leave the land of green triangles, my son points out that we're going to have to come back. There's another tree we need to help decorate. For Here and Now, I'm Sean Hurley.
And Sean Hurley lives at the foot of New Hampshire's White Mountains. Lucky guy. To see photos of the decorated trees he found in the woods, go to hereandnow.org. Today, 55 researchers from around the world begin a 3-month journey by ship from Cape Town, South Africa, to study the impacts of climate change around Antarctica. It will not be pretty. The effects of climate change in Antarctica are visible. Scientists have also predicted the loss of ice cover in the Arctic due to climate change. And there, it's going even faster than they expected. In Alaska, that ice loss is drastically affecting certain polar bears. You might have seen pictures in the New York Times this week. Skinny, hungry bears showing up in Kaktovik to forage the remains of hunted whales in that small Inuit village. Todd Atwood is a research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center, one of the lead agencies tracking these polar bears. He joins us now. Todd, welcome.
Thank you.
So first, this story that we were reading this week, it was so compelling. These bears, sometimes 80 at a time coming into town, the town only has a few hundred residents. Remind us why. They can't get out on ice floes?
Well, so what happens is September is when sea ice reaches its annual minimum extent. And September also coincides with the whaling season, the bowhead whale whaling season. And what we've seen over the last 15 or so years is an increasing amount of bears from the southern Beaufort Sea population, which is the population that we're talking about.
Right.
An increasing amount of bears from that population are coming ashore. They're coming ashore because there's no sea ice available anymore in summer over the continental shelf, which is a narrow stretch of shallow water off of the Alaska coast.
Yeah.
When that ice is gone, the bears come ashore and they hone in on that smell of the bowhead whale. Mm. And they aggregate around the village of Kaktovik, beginning as early as the middle of August, and they generally stay until the end of October.
Well, and we should say that these natives, the Inuits, who are these whale hunters, have permission to do it. It's a part of almost a religious ritual for them, and they dispose of the remains in sort of waste piles, and this is where the bears start, but then they sometimes wander in the village. And just we're understanding that the bears go out on this ice flow so that they can catch the seals there, that the people in the village could once see this ice shelf standing on shore, and now it's way out at sea.
Yeah, you know, we've been tracking changes in the availability of sea ice habitat for over 30 years in the southern Beaufort, and the changes have been, as you'd expect, really dramatic. Just in the last 15 years, we've seen the distance of the pack ice from the coast double. It's now well over 300 miles away from the coast during summer. And, you know, that's well beyond the continental shelf. That equates to basically a loss of habitat for the bears.
Yeah.
A loss of prime habitat. And that's why they're coming ashore in greater numbers.
Well, just to put a further point on it, we've done stories of people traveling in that area, completely separate stories, talking about one of the most heartbreaking things that they will see on sails is these polar bears who've who are going out to sea to try to find the ice floe and the seals, and it's not there, and they're getting into deeper and deeper water, and they're going to die.
Well, you know, we have recorded some pretty long-distance swims by bears. So every year we go out and sample or study the bears in the southern Beaufort. We do about a six-week field season. And one of the things that we do is tag about 20 or so bears with satellite transmitters. And from that, we've been able to record long-distance swims of bears leaving the coast and swimming to the pack ice and vice versa, leaving the pack ice and swimming to the coast. Mm. In some cases, we recorded swims of over 400, 500 miles.
Wow.
You know, that's a situation where a bear is getting in the water, thinking it's going to swim maybe to shore to begin denning. And obviously, it doesn't realize it has a 400 or 500-mile swim ahead of itself.
Yeah. Look, you have been to this village, we understand. As you say, you put collars on some of these bears. Let's just take a second, because these people are talking about, you know, they open their Arctic entryways. I guess it's the equivalent of our mudrooms, you know. And there might be a bear that's found something that has attracted it. They even have polar bear teams that go out to scare them away with firecrackers or lights to try to protect the people. What's it like to see these bears in something like a town as opposed to on the ice floe where you as a scientist might be used to seeing them?
Well, it's not necessarily a novelty. Bears have come into towns before and they're attracted by the smell of food. But what's really, I think, unprecedented about the situation in Kaktovik is the sheer number of bears that are coming to land. And then when those remains of the subsistence harvest whales run out, bears follow their nose into town because that's where people are storing, you know, the parts of the whale that they're going to consume. And I think in general, it's pretty amazing what the folks of Kaktovik have been able to do to manage that risk. As you mentioned, they've got a polar bear patrol that works 24/7 during that period of time when the whales are being brought in, when they're being butchered, when the shares of the whales are being distributed to the townspeople. But they're pretty much stretched to their full capacity. You know, it's not uncommon to have bears in town on a nightly basis during the month of September and into October. And that keeps that polar bear patrol hopping. They're using non-lethal deterrents. They're using things like cracker shells and beanbag shells to try and keep the bears out of town. They do a really good job of it. And it's a testament to their ability to work with these bears that there haven't been any serious injuries to people or bears in the last few years.
Well, or tourists, because hundreds of people are coming just to see them. They might bus in or fly in from Fairbanks, you know, on chartered planes. But another aspect of this, I mean, who would think about this, that these locals have these permafrost freezers. You know, they've been doing this for 100 years. It's so cold there, and that's where they store some of the whale meat. But those are melting because of the warming temperatures. So they're having to come up with freezers that will be bear resistant. There's a nonprofit, Defenders of Wildlife. It's sent Kaktovik these stainless steel food containers and these bear-resistant storage containers, which people are trying out there. So it's just, you know, the different ways their lives are changing, it's pretty interesting. But meantime, what's endgame here? I mean, yes, these bears that would maybe normally starve are now fattening up on the whale remains. But where does it go from here?
Well, that's obviously the key question. In the early 2000s, we estimated that about 4% of the population was coming ashore. And they were spending, you know, maybe 20 or so days on average on shore. So it was a pretty trivial set of circumstances. They were coming ashore in small amounts, and they weren't really spending much time on shore. In 2014, we estimated that close to 40% of the population came ashore. Mm. And they spent basically over 2 months on land. So if you're spending 2 months on land and you're a polar bear, that's 2 months less time you have to be on the sea ice hunting seals, depositing body fat. And there's a benefit of coming to shore in that you get to feed at the bone pile, but you're fasting until that time when the bone pile is stocked with the bowhead whale remains. So I think that for now, when you've got 20-30% of the population or so coming ashore, those bears are probably making the right decision. They have to fast for about 6 weeks, but they get this payoff of this really kind of energy-dense food, the blubber from the bowhead whale. The question is, if this trend continues, this trend of increasing bears coming ashore, what's the payoff going to be for those bears that feed? Because the amount of food at the bone pile doesn't really change much from year to year. So the more bears that come ashore means the less food for each bear to feed on. The other issue is the bone pile in Kaktovik is about, you know, a kilometer and a half from the village. And if you've got 200 bears hanging out in the village or on the outskirts of the village, and they run out of food at the bone pile, that's a lot of hungry bears to contend with coming into the village. And I worry that that's going to present a risk to people and also a risk to the bears.
Well, and the villagers would say they're the first ones who don't want the bears to be hurt, even as they're eating into their thawing permafrost freezers. Look, these are just one of the bear populations. There are 19 recognized bear populations, and not all of them are responding this way to sea ice loss. Some are stable, and that's feeding the theories that climate change isn't really happening because it's just this one bear population. What would you say to people who still, with what is overwhelming scientific evidence, and now this anecdotal evidence of bears in this town, still don't believe in climate change? What would you say?
Well, I would say that that just doesn't square with the facts. The changes in the extent and availability of sea ice are really well documented. And there's been dramatic declines in both the extent and the temporal or the timing of the availability of sea ice. The other thing I would suggest to people that are still kind of on the fence about climate change is visit one of these villages and talk to the people that live there. They're not on the fence of climate change. They realize the climate is changing because they're experiencing it every day.
They're not on the fence, they're on the front line. Todd Atwood, research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Last year, it was the infamous flame-prone hoverboard. The year before that, the equally infamous selfie stick. Now, with less than a week to go until Christmas and Hanukkah, what's made the list for this year's top tech gifts? And how well is the shopping season going overall? For that, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ina Fried is senior editor at Recode. She joins us from San Francisco. Ina, welcome back.
Hi, Magda.
Hi, and happy holidays to you. So for folks out there still looking for a gift, they're probably running out of time here. But what do you think this year's big it gift in tech might be?
Well, the biggest gift is an odd one, and it's hard to get your hands on. It's a retro Super Mario playing Nintendo game system that's basically a version of the original Nintendo game system. Obviously, to run that hardware today, you don't need very much, so it just plugs into your TV set. It only costs $60 if you can find it, but it's been sold out and very hard to find.
So I just first heard about this about 5 minutes ago before our conversation, and I looked it up, and my jaw dropped. No wonder it's so popular. I feel like there's an entire generation of adults now who just pine for the years of the early 80s.
Yeah, it's really great for two reasons. One, as I said, you know, it just doesn't require much hardware to replicate what took up a big system when we were kids. And also, you know, it's just not as hard as today's video games. You don't need eight hands to play it. So I kind of wanted one of these.
Yeah, you just need to be able to jump down a pipe and grab a mushroom. Simple stuff. Well, let's talk about the opposite end of the scale then in terms of complexity and modernity. There are some really hot gifts from Amazon, for example, that are also hard to get a hold of.
Yeah, so, I mean, these have been out for a while, but they've been very popular. So Amazon's line of Echo speakers, there's a few different ones, the main one and then a smaller one that connects to another speaker called the Dot. But basically, these are voice-controlled speakers, very popular, really. People like to have them in their kitchen. So this will play your music, it'll do web searches for you, and of course, Amazon hopes make you buy more stuff.
Yeah, so Amazon's actually done some great marketing, some stealthy marketing, I think, around Echo. For example, I saw Echo played a little cameo in the second season of Mr. Robot. There's a character, FBI agent Dominique DiPiero, who has an Alexa or an Echo in her home and responds to the name of Alexa, and it basically, it's her only friend, so I just wanted to play a little clip from that.
Alexa, when is the end of the world?
Unless it collides with a very large rock or a future technology goes very wrong indeed, Earth is most likely to be destroyed when the sun swells into a red giant in several billion years' time.
Right.
So an Alexa slash Echo there in Mr. Robot. But Ina, your colleague Jason Del Rey wrote that Amazon's been out of stock of this for some time. Did they underestimate how popular the Echo might be?
Yeah, I think demand has been stronger than they expected, although, you know, this is kind of the interesting thing with Amazon. You never know exactly how many they're selling. They only talk in adjectives. So they'll be like, we sold more Echoes than ever before. And it's like, well, of course you did. And, you know, their Kindle was the kindliest Kindle ever. So it's very hard to get a sense. But clearly this is popular. It's so popular that other electronics makers are going after this. Google has a similar product called Google Home. Microsoft said to be working on something similar. For Google, it's really important because, you know, a lot of searches are being done on Alexa through Amazon, and they're also building Alexa into other products, non-Amazon products. So it's actually, in addition to being a hot gift, it's a really competitive area of the tech landscape.
Interesting. Business-wise, there's also the ability to create demand by scarcity as well, but I'm not saying that Amazon's actually doing that. Let's turn to something that Snapchat put out that's really hot. Spectacles. Those are the glasses designed for use with Snapchat. Are those super popular this holiday season?
Well, this really is a case of demand by scarcity. So Snapchat isn't really selling these broadly. They have some pop-up kiosks and vending machines that they're moving from city to city. These aren't broadly available. These are sort of, you know, attempt number two at sort of Google Glass. So if Google Glass was for nerds, this is trying to be a little bit hipper. It really only does one thing, which is record video that can then be broadcast. So, you know, more limited than Google Glass, but also potentially more popular. You know, I'm not sure this is mainstream yet. We'll see. Again, there's only a few of these out there right now.
Yeah. So, you know, I wonder what you think about this. I mean, we've been talking about actual gadgets here so far, but Farhad Manjoo at the New York Times wrote an article earlier this month where he kind of said that we're upon a gadget apocalypse, mostly because smartphones and apps are able to do so many things that we used to look for gadgets to do. I mean, and so maybe we won't actually be buying as many gadgets anymore. So what do you make of that argument?
Well, I love Farhad, but I'd respectfully disagree. I think, you know, it is very true that the smartphone has killed a ton of existing gadgets. So we used to carry, cameras, we used to carry recorders, we used to carry all kinds of things that the smartphone has definitely replaced. But I would argue we're entering a new renaissance with very cool things that attach to the smartphone. So you can attach a small microscope, you can attach a better camera, you can attach a robot, all these things that connect to the smartphone. And you don't have to add as much computing power into these things because you have the phone nearby.
Ina Fried, senior editor at Recode. Thanks so much, Ina. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's away. This is Here and Now.